Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. I am delighted to welcome to this week's Talk Nation Radio, Anna Edwards, who is the host and producer of her own radio show, Defenders Live, which is on WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and streams online as well. Anna Edwards is also the chair of the Sacred Ground Historical Reclamation Project, which has been reclaiming and protecting African-American burial grounds in Richmond, Virginia. And Anna has recently been to Mali, and that is what we're going to be talking about. Anna Edwards, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Well, thank you, David. I'm delighted to be here.
For those who don't know anything about Mali whatsoever, and I would include myself, where is it? What is it? What should people know about the nation of Mali?
Well, Mali is in West Africa. It is the largest country in West Africa. It is a former French colony and has been independent since 1960. It has a population of about 16 million people. The principal language spoken in Mali is Bambara, aside from the official French language, and it is made up of many ethnicities, in part because it has been a part of the Southern Sahara Sahelian trade route for many, many, many centuries. Its principal export, I think, at this point is gold, but rice, cotton, and some of its minerals have prominent roles to play, both in the crisis that's going on right now and in its larger economy.
And how did you come to visit Mali?
In 2005, I became part of an organization called the Virginia Friends of Mali. And in 2009, Virginia Friends of Mali facilitated a sister city relationship between Ségou, which is the second largest city in Mali, and Richmond, Virginia. And the purpose of the Virginia Friends of Mali was to support teachers for our third and sixth graders in the Virginia public school system to learn about the Empire of Mali, which had recently been added to the standards of learning curriculum.
Is there a historical connection between Mali and people in Richmond?
There is, actually. In fact, in my work to reclaim Richmond's African burial ground, which is in downtown Richmond, what we learned about the history of that burial ground was that it was an active burial ground throughout the 1700s and into the very early 19th century, and that the majority of the Africans who were enslaved and brought to these shores in that period came from what was then known as the Senegambia region, and that includes Senegal, Mali, Niger, Ivory Coast, Ghana, those areas also known as Liberia and Sierra Leone. That entire region was once part of the Empire of Mali. And so from that trade in enslaved Africans, we know that most of the people who are likely buried in the burial ground in Richmond came from that area. And therefore, many of our ancestors in Richmond today are descendants of that region.
So not necessarily from the current nation of Mali, but from the greater region that was once known as Mali.
Well, yeah, I would say that it started then, but certainly over the course of the 20th century, and certainly over the last, say, 35 to 40 years, with the increase in African immigration to the United States, we have Malian populations in the city of Richmond right now. So there is both the historical and the contemporary connection for our two cities. And there are other similarities that are either coincidental or charming, if you want to look at it that way. Both of our cities share, our state, share a tremendous musical tradition that is demonstrated by the our folk festivals and the Crooked Road music tribute that goes on every year here. Mali has the Festival of the Desert in the Timbuktu region, and then it has the Festival Sur le Niger, which is in Ségou itself. And both of those are tributes and opportunities to share phenomenal centuries-old musical traditions. And in fact, one of the direct connections between Mali's musical culture and Virginia's musical culture is the Piedmont blues tradition. And so people like Cephas and Wiggins, who regularly performed at Richmond's Folk Festival, were able to share music that is very familiar to Virginians that actually directly can trace its root to Molly.
That's incredible history to know about as a Virginian who didn't. And this sister city relationship is something I'm a huge fan of. What has come in recent years since this relationship was established? What exchanges have there been between Richmond and Segu?
There have been, again, both musicians from here have gone to play in festivals there. Musicians from Mali have played in our Richmond Folk Festival on several occasions. One of the most popular at the festival 2 years ago was a group called Baseku Kuyate Ngoni Ba. And they are a contemporary group which plays traditional Ngoni stringed instruments, but in a standing up and in a very contemporary way, and they were really quite dynamic. They are also very vocal critics of the crisis that's going on, and so some of those musicians are serving as ambassadors of both information and protest about the situation, which we'll talk about a little later. But in addition to that, in 2009, once we formally established the relationship, the Virginia Friends of Mali was able to work with the City of Richmond's Sister City Commission to apply for a grant for a water health and sanitation project, which we have just completed. And that was to work with a local committee in Segu to identify their water health sanitation-related priorities and determine how to spend $115,000. That was the grant amount. And the decision was made to build 32 bathrooms and wash stations in public locations. So there is a public market that serves 2,000 people a day, as well as being adjacent to a mosque, which during Friday prayers is important for the wash stations, because washing of the face, hands, and feet is an important part of the prayer ritual. And then, of course, serving 2,000 customers who come through that area to actually have restrooms and wash stations is very helpful. There is a public kindergarten that serves 500 children under the age of 5 that had only 3 bathrooms to serve that entire population. And there are now a bank of 8 bathrooms and wash stations for the children there. The particular point for the kindergarten is that malaria is dangerous and potentially deadly for children under the age of 5, and sanitation is the key to that, hand washing and preventing the spread of germs that way. And so that has had tremendous impact. And then the third set of bathrooms were constructed at a local community health center, which serves 44,000 people every year and is the principal maternity clinic for that area. And so a new bank of bathrooms and wash stations were constructed there. That was done in 2011, and we have just done the final inspection for their use over the past year. And everything, aside from a couple of glitches, is going very well. And the city has been really, really pleased with that particular project. So I'd say that's one of the biggest ones. But we have ongoing projects underway, including recently signed agreements between the Sister City Commission, Virginia Friends of Mali, and Virginia Commonwealth University with the new University of Segu and the longstanding University of Bamako, which is in the capital city of Mali. So this is just some of the projects that are underway.
We are speaking with Anna Edwards, who is the host and producer of Defenders Live in Richmond, Virginia, and who has recently been to Mali. We've referred a few times to the crisis in Mali. We've talked about useful things that are being taken to Mali, but I'm afraid weapons and war are being taken to Mali as well. What is this crisis, and where did it come from?
When you talk about crises in Africa, you're going to talk about several factors. And what has happened in Mali is the result of what I can only politely refer to as a perfect storm of competing agendas. And one of the most immediate thing that is in the news at the moment is the fact that Mali is under attack by a group of people that are being referred to as jihadists. And it's probably as accurate as you're going to get in terms of a description of the northern-based forces that are in part the result of a Tuareg rebellion. And the Tuareg are originally a nomadic people, which have some of its roots in the northern areas of Mali, but also of Niger and Algeria and Mauritania and at a certain point into the country of Chad, and for a while in Libya. The rebellion that took place in 2011, in January, of 2012, really is sort of a follow-up to long-standing grievances that the Tuareg people have had since Mali attained its independence from France in 1960. But in order not to sort of spend too much time going over that background, I'll just say that their rebellion then was in part co-opted by a more jihadist perspective, which has been led by someone who was born in Mali, a man named Iyad Ag Gali, and who was a member of a dynastic family in northern Mali of the Tuareg, and went from being part of a sort of secular rebellion movement to now being part of a Salafist or fundamentalist Islamic thrust in terms of their interest now in taking over the rest of Mali in order to impose a fundamentalist version of Sharia law. That then, of course, is coincided by the fact that over the last several years, there has been a significant smuggling trade that has gone on across the northern part of Mali and through this Sahelian region. It's basically taking advantage of trade routes that have been around for hundreds of years, but which has no other good economy for the people in that region. The desert of the Sahara, of course, has been growing all these years, and the economies for local populations has gotten worse and worse as water sources have declined and agriculture has declined. So, unfortunately, what happens in areas of tremendous poverty is that whatever economy can help people sustain themselves is what is what ends up being supported. Afghanistan, of course, has had to deal with the poppy production and cocaine route. And, of course, Mali is now one of those victims as well. And it started with some cigarette smuggling and moved into drug smuggling. And that, along with kidnappings by some of the Al-Qaeda forces, as they've been identified, along with Iyad Ag Gali, has provided a lot of money in that region. And with those resources, both this jihadist formation, but also those who are simply interested in continuing, you know, their pursuit of profits through smuggling for that region, have been able to really solidify their control of that region. Now, take that and add to it the geopolitical interests of the United States, of France, and China, just to name the three largest players in that area. And France, of course, is interested in maintaining as much control as it can with its former colony. It currently continues to maintain control of its banking system, and right now, of course, is on the ground militarily, having come in on January 11th, I believe, in order to push back on the most recent attacks that occurred in the southern part of the country in the middle of last month. The U.S., of course, is looking to secure its own base and has been working on doing that ever since it established AFRICOM, or the Africa Command, which currently has its base in Stuttgart, Germany, but has been deploying troops to more than 33 countries in Africa over the last month or so, but has actually been working on that process for the last 5 to 10 years as well. And then you have China, which has been coming in, putting tremendous resources into buying land and building infrastructure projects in Mali and in other African countries in order to secure their trade relations with these countries as well. So all of these players have their role in the crisis, which has succeeded in destabilizing Mali to such an extent that its government was overthrown, and it is working with a transitional government at this moment, has not had elections since the coup d'etat, which took place last January. And the Malian army and the idea of sort of a unified resistance to what's happening is not very strong. And so Mali is in a state of crisis in many, many directions. And, of course, the people who suffer are the people trying to live their lives and avoid being killed or traumatized by what's going on. At this point, more than 400,000 people have been displaced, both as refugees outside the country and internally.
To what extent has the recent war making in Libya contributed to violence in Mali?
Libya's collapse when Muammar Gaddafi was defeated and killed, actually resulted in sort of the tipping point, in a way, for the rebellion by the Tuareg independence group in January of 2012. What happened as a part of, again, sort of the impoverishment of the area and the need for employment was that the Malian government supported Libya's invitation to provide them with soldiers for its own army. And Gaddafi actually formed what was called the Islamic Legion in the 1980s and 90s. And that was specifically a Tuareg battalion. So these are people who have, or soldiers who have been trained by the Libyan military structure and provided with armaments. And when Gaddafi was killed, they returned to Mali as men who have been trained over the past 20 to 30 years, who came with their armaments, with their weaponry. And that, coupled with the growing frustration with the Tuareg situation in northern Mali at this point, they saw the opportunity to organize and stage another rebellion. The last significant rebellion was in 1990 and 91. And what's interesting is that the leader of this current rebellion and jihadist force, Iyad Ghali, was also a young leader in the rebellion in 1990 and 91. But then he became also a mediator for the to end that rebellion and began working with the Malian government for a number of years as a mediator. And it's been over the last 10 years or so that he began to sort of shift his interest and his allegiances to a more religious focus as opposed to the secular or national sovereignty kind of focus, and emerged as this leader in northern Mali. And again, so the collapse of Libya has contributed both skill and weaponry to those forces which were interested in both the rebellion, but now in the jihadist goal of transforming Mali into a Sharia law state.
We see the word slavery thrown around in reference to the condition of some people in Mali, in modern day Mali. What is that referring to?
Well, this is an historic dynamic that we're talking about, and I'll say that I'm truthfully learning about this as I go along as well. I have not gotten as much information about it, but I've learned from friends who are from Mauritania as well as from Mali that there is a longstanding, relationship in terms of both Arab, older Arab communities or Arab-based communities and Black African communities and slavery. We talk a lot, of course, in the U.S. about the history of slavery of Europeans and the New World with Africans. We don't know as much, we tend not to know as much about this history with the Arab and North African world. And it's an older history, and there are, longstanding relationships between groups of people that have been, that have involved slavery. Sometimes it is a dynamic of skin color, but less often than you would think. It's more often about ethnicities and about tribal affiliations, but as usual, it's also primarily about power and profit dynamics. So my understanding is that there are what they call the nobility of the Tuareg, who have enslaved a group of people called the Bela. And generally speaking, the Tuareg tend to be lighter skinned, and generally speaking, the Bela tend to be darker skinned. But the intermarrying among Africans is such that that's never a good way to assess the situation. It does not change the fact that those longstanding tensions can result in some of the problems that we're seeing now. That now that the rebellions and the attacks that have gone on have resulted in some retaliations against Tuareg and Arab-appearing people in southern Mali and in northern Mali, where the government or French troops have retaken control of some of these territories. And that's one of the unfortunate byproducts of the complicated nature of the history of the peoples of this area.
What do you think are the interests and motivations of the governments of France and the United States and China? I mean, clearly, historically, the interests of France have not been those of humanitarian aid, but of colonization. There's been discussion in the news of France's desire for resources, including uranium. The United States is obviously militarizing its presence in Africa, building drone bases around the region, seeking to establish a presence for AFRICOM and perhaps to compete with China. What are the forces at play, and what are the motivations, good ones, if any, and bad?
Well, you know, in terms of the United States, if you go to the AFRICOM website, and if you follow, you know, at least a third of the headlines that come through our major news sources, what you will see is that the United States has taken on the, you know, the very special burden of moving into Africa in order to work with primarily the West and Northern African nations to prevent or respond to terrorism threats. And that, I have to say, at this point, is sort of the most contemporary justification. And then in other sort of secondary layers, they will talk about responding to humanitarian requests for support of internal problems by the heads of states of certain governments. And, of course, they've been providing support in the Congo. They are active in Mali. They have been active in East Africa quite significantly, you know, in Ethiopia and Kenya, and they've been involved with South Africa to a certain extent, and then of course all of what was involved in their involvement with NATO and what we've called the Arab Spring in the North African countries. For the U.S., it's geopolitical control, and Mali, and especially in northern Mali, in the Kidal region, there is. If you can control the territory of northern Mali. As a power such as the United States or France or China, then you are geopolitically positioned to control most of the upper half or northern half of Africa. And from there, you have the ability to be a threat or a resource to your allies or your enemies pretty much, you know, around the globe. The resources in the area that have been identified, of course, are oil and uranium. And again, there are the trade routes and the smuggling route along there and the network of people with skills and abilities to navigate that desert terrain that outsiders simply don't have. France is interested in maintaining its relationship of power with Mali and its access to its resources, and uranium would be one because uranium is, of course, important to nuclear energy, and France is one of the nations, one of the Western nations most dependent on nuclear energy. But it's economically interested, and Mali represents one of its larger former colonial holdings, but it has those kinds of relationships throughout West Africa. The Ivory Coast is another country which has relied on France to step in at different times when its, you know, power structure has been threatened by, you know, either rebellion or change or attack. And then China, again, as I referred to, I think is at this point a matter of economic interest primarily. They're looking to get their foothold in, and they seem to be doing it through infrastructure projects, significant loans and purchases in African countries where their most desperate need is infrastructure. One of the problems of colonialism, and particularly at the end of the colonial era in the 1950s and 60s, was that these European powers gutted these countries of the resources that had been put in place. They either took away the expertise or they took away the very material and left them without the ability to continue their development unless they maintained or resecured ties to their former colonizers. In Mali, one of the most intriguing and obvious ones is that they literally pulled up their railroad tracks and took them home, leaving Mali without a good internal transport system for their trade. And so they have had to rely on very poor road systems and have not been able to develop the water trade that you might imagine, given that the Niger River is one of the third largest rivers in Africa and is the lifeblood of the agricultural life of this country. So, you know, the interests and the possibilities are significant as usual because Africa continues to be phenomenally resource-rich and not nearly as exploited as the West would like to be able to take advantage of.
Anna, in 60 seconds or less, what can people do, organizations do? What should governments be doing if they actually want to serve the interests of the people of Mali?
At this point, if you want to serve the interests of the people of Mali, you need to be looking at the U.S.'s relationship to Africa as a whole. It's kind of too late, in a way, to directly impact what is happening in Mali on the ground. And I say that because it is going to be very important and most important for Malians themselves to come together and figure out how they are going to respond as a nation of people in order to redefine themselves coming out of this crisis. But the most important thing that we can do is really call for what we know may be very difficult, and that is for the U.S. and AFRICOM to get out of Africa. It is to emphasize the fact that we understand our foreign policy is based on profit and that we need to be pulling out of Africa, let these African countries develop themselves and get out of the way of their being able to establish fair trade relations in order that they can develop their economies and grow. And we need to be paying attention to the fact, again, that money that we need here at home is being spent on these enterprises, and that we need to stop using the cover of terrorism and very superficial and not ultimately useful in the long term humanitarian projects, which are not actually doing what they intend to do, or what we think they intend to do, which is actually help people get off, get out from under this kind of oppression. But the main call would be for the United States to get out of Africa, for the AFRICOM to get out of Africa, to close these drone bases and these military bases, who really are like the early missionaries and exploratory groups from the 1500s, which were only in there on the pretext to do good work and, in fact, established military bases and rationale for remaining in these countries and exerting control that they should not have. The U.S. needs to get out of Africa.
Anna Edwards is the host and producer of Defenders Live on WRIR out of Richmond, Virginia, which streams online. You can learn more there. Anna, thanks for being on Talk Nation Radio.
Very welcome.
As our government was making a fraudulent case to attack Iraq in 2002-2003, the MSNBC television network was doing everything it could to help, including booting Phil Donahue and Jeff Cohen off the air. The Donahue Show was deemed likely to be insufficiently war-boosting and was thus removed 10 years ago next week, and 10 days after the largest anti-war or anything else demonstrations in the history of the world, as a preemptive strike against the voices of honest, peaceful people. From there, MSNBC proceeded to support the war with mild critiques around the edges and to white out the idea of impeachment or accountability. But now, MSNBC has seen its way clear to airing a documentary about the fraudulent case it assisted in, a documentary called Hubris. This short film pointed out the role of the New York Times in defrauding the public, but not MSNBC's role. Yet my primary response is joy rather than disgust. It is now cool to acknowledge war lies. Truth tellers, including truth tellers rarely presented with a corporate microphone, made that happen. According to Hubris, the war propaganda may have just been incompetence or hubris. It wasn't. Not only does overwhelming evidence show us that Bush knew his claims about WMDs to be false, but the former president has shown us that he considers the question of truth or falsehood as laughably irrelevant. MSNBC and Hubris steer us away from any ideas of accountability, and no connection is drawn to current war lies about Iran or other nations. But the production of programs like this one that prolong Americans' awareness of the lies that destroyed Iraq are the best hope Iran has right now. MSNBC should be contacted and applauded for airing this and urged to follow up on it. This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. All past shows can be found at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. Until next time.